Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
When we were talking with Lise Doucette at the top of the programme, we were wondering what the casualty total was in Gaza. Now, we just have, by coincidence, from the health ministry in Hamas-run Gaza, a new figure on that death toll. They say that it has crossed 40,000 people now in the more than 10-month war between Israeli and Palestinian militants. A recent report published by the Department of Environment shows that while Irish people have good awareness of climate change and the damage that it is doing, we have difficulty translating that awareness into taking actual action. Among its findings are that young people are unwilling in particular to give up flying, and men are very reluctant to reduce their intake of meat. Professor Pete Lunn is the head of the Behavioural Research Unit at the ESRI. He is here now to talk to us about some of this research. Give us the snapshot here first, please, Pete.
It's very complex. The snapshot's quite a big one, because climate change is a policy challenge unlike any other we've seen. It involves so many aspects of our lives, our transport behaviour, our energy behaviour, what we eat and so on. But essentially, what this research and some other research that we're increasingly doing is showing is that while attitudes and opinions are actually pretty well aligned, and what I mean by that is most people recognise, in fact, the overwhelming majority recognise that climate change is happening, that it is human-caused. We're lucky in Ireland. We have very few climate deniers. They are also worried about it. So most people recognise it's happening. They are worried about it, and they express willingness to change in general. And accepting, I think, that the degree of change that might be involved to lives and lifestyles is large. However, translating that into concrete actions that are really making a difference is where life gets more difficult, because what people need to perceive, what they need to understand, the technologies they need to adopt, the degree to which it involves communities is really complicated.
So in a line, Lord help me stop sinning, just not quite yet.
I wouldn't put it like that, if I'm honest. I mean, I think it is true that we can often put off difficult decisions, and there's some behavioural economics to suggest that we tend to worry more about the immediate than we worry about the future. But I don't think it is all us just kicking the can down the road here. And I think there's been an explosion in behavioural research in this area. Some of that's government funded, and that's great because we really need it, because we're starting to see how complex the behavioural pattern is. So let me just give you a sort of really brief idea of this. For many policy problems I would work on, government would have a policy that it thinks really needs to be enacted to get some goal or other. You'd do an attitude and opinion study and you say, oh, you know, do people support this? Do they not support it? If they don't support it, why? There'd be a bit of persuasion involved, and then government decides, does it have to compromise a bit or does it just push it through? Climate change is just not like that. The attitudes and opinions are aligned. But how people can perceive the problem, how they understand the problem, whether they realise which of their individual daily actions makes a difference, whether other people around them are doing them as well, or whether they might feel kind of foolish if they're the one who sticks their neck out and tries it. There's so much more psychological complexity about how we as people are approaching the climate problem.
What level of priority are we attaching to it? There are so many things demanding our attention every day. We're in the middle of a cost of living crisis, as we've just heard, the horrible events in Gaza that are just assailing us day in, day out. Where in the hierarchy of concerns that we might address does climate change appear in Ireland?
So that's a great question. It's quite hard to measure as a social scientist. I think the best way to measure it is to spontaneously ask people. So you don't give them a list and then say, which of these do you think is most important? You say, what springs to mind to you now as the most important issues? We did that a few years ago, and climate change was the third ranked issue in Ireland behind housing and health. Now, I suspect if we repeated that exercise, that cost of living and possibly immigration would appear up there as well. But climate change is definitely in the top handful of issues that immediately spring to mind when you ask people what are the biggest challenges facing the country.
Why then, if we are convinced of the science, convinced of the need to do something, are we having such a problem in translating that into action?
Well, as an individual, it's incredibly difficult. I mean, there are so many things I could do right from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep. what I'm eating, how I'm travelling around, how I'm heating my home, how I'm heating my water, which devices I'm using.
That's just overwhelming.
Right, yeah, it's an overwhelming complexity. And I mean, we've measured people's understanding of this. I mean, we've asked people, we've given them sort of 12 or 15 actions, for example, that they could take in their daily lives and said to them, you know, which of these do you think have a big impact and which have a low impact? And people get it completely wrong. And that's totally understandable because the science of what produces emissions is really, really complex. Now, there are some interesting biases in there that are consistent. So it isn't just that people don't know. There are certain things that people definitely underestimate. And one of those is diet. So people have a good idea that their energy consumption, when they're using devices or where they're heating their homes and their water, makes a difference. Okay. And how they travel makes a difference. They're less inclined to understand that actually what you eat on a daily basis is one of the biggest contributors. And the global food industry is one of the biggest contributors to emissions. What you eat really matters.
And Irish men in particular are loath to change their habits in this area.
I'm going to kick back at you here, right? You've just said they're loath to, right? This is what often happens when social science goes into the public domain. There is a statistically significant difference between men and women on their willingness to change their diet. But it is small compared to the proportion of people who have already tried to change their diet for environmental reasons and are expressing a willingness to do so but struggling to. So the gender difference really isn't very important.
So I should have said Irish men and women are loath to
change
their diet.
No, because actually what's interesting is that when you measure this properly, you find that a quarter of the population will tell you they've already changed their diet and can tell you how for environmental reasons. And that there's another quarter of the population who say that they are willing to do that, but they struggle to do it. And when you ask them why, it turns out part of the problem is knowledge. They don't really understand which foods that they might eat are more linked to emissions. And also, they think it's more expensive because a lot of products that sell themselves as environmentally friendly do tend to be more expensive. But actually, just what it is that you eat, whether you eat the types of food that produce high emissions versus the types that produce low emissions, where there is no cost difference, just what you eat is the thing that makes the largest difference.
I wonder then, when you do something that is more deliberate or is more informative and you take people through the range of possible options that would be open to them if they wanted to become more flexitarian, do they find that more acceptable than being confronted with the stark question, would you stop eating steak?
I think the honest answer to your question is actually, as of now, we don't know. So multiple interventions have been tried in different countries, and we've tried some of them in our own research here, where you're trying to improve people's knowledge as a way of, and the options that are available to them, improve their knowledge about how those are linked to emissions as a way of trying to get behaviour change. But information interventions like that often have quite small effects, if any effect, and that's exactly what we discovered. You can improve people's education and information. It often doesn't make a big difference. And the reason it doesn't make a big difference is that it's really complex, because you also have to change their habits, improve the way supermarkets are laid out, change labelling. You know, there's so much more than information and education that matters to the environment. You were talking earlier about how important the food environment is to what people choose. Well, exactly the same is true about whether they choose food that is more environmentally friendly and has lower emissions.
Can we move on to flying? Because it is undoubtedly one of the most heavy emitting activities that we all engage in. I'm very struck by the contrast between young people in this country's apparent reluctance to change their habits in this area and a survey I saw from France very recently, where a very large number of people under the age of 25 said that it would be acceptable to them to only ever take one long-haul flight in their entire lives. Now, maybe it's a function of living on an island and not having a good train service that young people in this country are going to feel very differently about that. But that was a very stark contrast.
Yes, I mean, I think it's definitely true that if you live in a smaller country, and if you live on an island that's a smaller country, you are going to want to travel more, particularly as a young person. And that's what this latest research finds. And we've found this as well. And obviously, options are limited. While it is true that the sail rail option of getting to the UK has improved over the years, it's still not great. I mean, it could still be made much more convenient and easy for people to have alternative options. But it is hard to see the degree to which we can reduce the amount of flying among young people who are, you know, wanting to do that for all sorts of important reasons about expansion in their lives and getting experience and all the rest of it. However, there are things that we absolutely can do when it comes to flying. And one of the things that's very interesting is the proportion of people who are flying a lot is actually very low, much lower than people think. There's a really good question to ask about how many of those journeys that are made by people who are flying a lot are actually necessary. And there's a good question to ask about whether it makes sense for there to be some kind of frequent flyer levy if it's the case that people who are flying very regularly are contributing the most to emissions. Well, should we be doing something about that and trying to incentivize them not to, so that it's fine for people to take one or two flights a year when they're going on holiday? It's the people taking 5, 6, 10, 15 that are making a really big difference. And that's also important because one of the things that's interesting about climate change is that individuals instinctively view it collectively. So it's pretty rough to say to somebody, hey, don't go on holiday this year on a flight because of the climate change consequences, when they know that there are business flights that are taking place of people flying 15, 20 times a year. There are people who are rich enough to be flying private jets. Fairness matters an awful lot because this is a collective problem and people instinctively understand it that way. So I think tackling, from when it comes to flying, tackling the issue of people who are flying a very large amount, often where it's really not essential, is probably a good place to start.
Yeah, I'm always struck by a figure that was calculated by the Drawdown Project that 80 billion hours a year are spent in airport departure lounges and on aeroplanes when people could just do a Zoom. Can I move on to heating systems and heat pumps? What are our resistance levels to this technology like now?
So we need to do a lot more work on people's interface with technology adoption in different areas. But what we know at the moment, I think, is that there's a greater willingness to embrace solar, probably followed by retrofitting as something that people are willing to consider and embrace. And heat pumps are kind of coming a little bit behind that, I think.
Really, that is fascinating, that people would be more willing to engage with retrofitting than just putting a heat pump outside.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem is that the research that we've seen to date suggests that there's a particular problem with heating systems, which is people tend to stick with the one they've got until it breaks. And then it's an emergency. And so you need to deal with it really quickly. So the idea you'll then take a kind of considered long-term decision to install a completely different kind of system that might take longer is unlikely to happen. You're much more likely to replace with, for example, the gas or oil boiler that you currently have and stick with the system you have. So there's a real problem there, actually, in getting a more strategic approach to the installation of heating systems within houses. Whereas if you think about retrofitting, that's a decision to improve the insulation in your house, to improve the efficiency of your house that you can make at any point in a longer considered way. You're not going to make it in an emergency situation. So that's one of the things that the research highlights. This is the kind of thing where this research is so important, because often we think it's kind of obvious. And it's only when you start really digging into how people actually make decisions in real life that you can start to see the pathways to make it easier for them, more convenient and fairer for them to change what they're doing.
That's really the key thing here, isn't it, for policymakers to pay attention to. If you make this low-hanging fruit, if you make these things easy to do and cheap for people to do, well, then what you're saying is there's not going to be much resistance to doing it.
I would simplify it to this. So I'm going to say what you've said and add a bit. Okay, so yes, if you want people to change their behaviour at the most simple level, make it cheap. Make it easy and convenient for them, but also make it fair so that they're not being asked to do something other people are not being asked to do, that they can see that everyone is pulling their weight. So you want it to be fair. And the other thing is, the more you can get people to do it collectively as communities, the better. And that's one of the things where this latest report from government is actually really strong, and it's really good to see. That it isn't just about top-down policies setting in place frameworks like taxes and subsidies and one-stop shops and all this kind of stuff. Getting communities to engage in climate action so it is a genuine collective thing is really important, that there's some bottom-up as well. And there's good evidence to suggest that people are much, much more willing to engage in climate action when they're part of a community that's doing it and can take pride in the fact that it's changing its transport system, it's changing its energy system, it's changing its land use.
If fairness is one of the key metrics here, along with cheap and easy, have you any bright ideas on how it is that you would ask a community, like, say, farmers, of whom more is going to have to be asked than the ordinary average householder? Have you any ideas about how we make that more fair, that transition?
Yes.
And you have because, 1 minute.
No, I do. How many of them I'm willing to voice right here, right now, because I'm a cautious researcher who wants to look into these things and test some hypotheses. But what I would say is where people are being asked to make larger changes to things like production systems and lifestyles that have existed for generations, there's a really good question to ask over the timescale that it is reasonable to ask them to do that over, how we get agreement about that so that we can put in place regulations that people know are coming in over time with a degree of certainty. Mm. So you say, well, okay, we know it's hard for you to do this, but what would it take? And that we reach good agreements there where there's a kind of, there's an understandable fair contract, if you like, rather than there's just a kind of top-down pressure that says, oh, you've got to do this now. Here's your target. Okay. You've got to meet it. So I think
it's easy to get on board with something where there's an indicative roadmap that sets out key markers along a sort of a 10-year journey.
I think that makes things much better. And by that, I don't just mean, you know, targets that we've laid out over 10 years. I mean, you sit down and you say, right, what is fair here? And you do look at what other sectors are doing. You say, well, look, actually, what are we asking of the energy sector? What are we asking of the industrial sector? What are we asking of ordinary citizens who live in cities? You know, and we make the comparison, you know, and we actually say, okay, you know, this is what's being asked of each of us. Because the more you put it into a context where people can see that others are pulling their weight, what all the research suggests is the more likely you are to be successful in getting behaviour change.
Pete Lunn, fascinating as always. We've only really scratched the surface of this report here. It is available on the ESRI site, is it?
This isn't an ESRI report, importantly. No, what we were talking about today, to a large extent, was a government report. However, I've also referenced a lot of research that is up on the ESRI website in the course of this conversation. There's multiple studies here.
Professor Pete Lunn, a behavioural economist with the ESRI. Thank you very much. Let's take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.